This morning, we're going to do things a little differently. I'm going to tell you a story. And for most of us, it's a story with which you are already familiar. But it's a story that I can't tell in its entirety due to time constraints. We'd be here a couple of days if I did that. So, we're going to start this morning's story right where we left off from the Lord's Supper. Jesus is in the upper room. He understands that his time on earth is short. He's got less than 18 hours at this point. Now think about that. If you knew you were going to die in 18 hours, what would you do with your time? Who'd you want to be with? What would you be trying to convey? It seemed to me as I was reading over these passages over and over this week that the primary message Jesus is trying to convey is love. Do you know that this night is not going to be a pleasant night for any of them? But Jesus is working hard to convey his love to the apostles. But he doesn't just want his love to go from him to the apostles. He wants the apostles to figure out how to love one another. And he's still struggling with that because they're not quite there yet. So, after instituting the Lord's Supper, Jesus takes time to wash the apostles' feet. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is he doing that? Why is Jesus bothering to wash their feet? Well, if you look at what was happening just prior to him washing the feet, the disciples are having another dispute about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom. Now, we touched on that a little bit this morning in class. This is not the first argument they've had about that. Who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom? And Jesus isn't participating in the argument. Jesus gets up, takes off his outer clothes, wraps himself with a towel, pours a basin of water, and starts washing feet. And I think that largely the irony is lost on his apostles. Because they're still arguing about who's going to be the greatest. We don't know how many of the apostles' feet that Jesus washes before he gets to Peter. But Peter is the class problem child. Some of you teachers, you know who this guy is. Peter's having none of it. No, Lord, you are not going to wash my feet. Now, Jesus, as the consummate teacher, says, Peter, if you're not going to cooperate, you're going to leave the room. That's paraphrased. What he says is, you'll have no part of me. Peter says, okay, Lord, I tell you what, this is what we'll do. You wash my feet, my hands, and my head. And you got to support Jesus. Peter, you don't need a bath. Rest of you's good. You need your feet washed. And Peter finally does stick out his feet. He finally gets to that point where he says, all right, Lord. I have to imagine Jesus smiling at him when this uncooperative student finally agrees to stick out his feet like he was told in the first place. And then he explains that he washed their feet for their benefit. But he didn't wash their feet so their feet would be clean. He was trying to teach them a lesson. Jesus asks, why are you guys arguing about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? He said, you call me Lord and you call me Master and you're right on both counts. But I just washed your feet. And you know what? I need you to do this for each other. Now, shortly after this, Judas gets identified as the betrayer. Jesus dips the bread, hands it to Judas, and tells him to go do what you're going to go do quickly. Now, Jesus knows exactly what Judas is going to go do, but apparently there's, again, some confusion among the apostles about what it is that Judas is going to go do. Well, as soon as Judas leaves the room, Jesus issues a new command. And he tells them, "A new command I give you. Love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. For by this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Now, we realize, of course, that love one another is not all that new. We have that in Leviticus. You know the new part of this? Love one another as I have loved you. What did you do? I washed your feet. I, your Lord and Master, did something that was necessary to be done because I loved you. Jesus says he's going away, and Peter says, "Where are you going, Lord?" And Jesus says, "Where I'm going, Peter, you can't go." But he adds an addendum. And he tells Peter that he's prayed for him. He says, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat." Now, if that didn't get Peter's attention, I don't know that anything would come up. There are other places in the New Testament where we learn that the demons know our names. That bothers me. But Jesus looks at Peter and he says, "But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. My Lord and my Master prayed for me." Have you ever had somebody look you in the face and tell you, "I'm praying for you"? It is a powerful, powerful thing. Jesus adds that last bit down there, and he says, "When you have turned back, strengthen your brothers, Peter." Peter doesn't even know what he's getting here, because Peter doesn't know what's coming. Christ is offering him grace before he needs it. "What do you mean, turn back, Lord? I'm good. I'm here. I'm with you. I'm ready to die with you." And Jesus says, "When you come back, strengthen your brothers." Jesus tells him, "Peter, before the rooster crows today, you're going to deny me three times." Peter's not buying it, of course. But he tries. And then Jesus makes a larger announcement to the room. And he tells them that he's going to prepare a mansion for them. And we use this version only because my brother Reuben prefers this version. He's not even here this morning. Some versions say, "I'm going to prepare a room for you," and brother Reuben prefers to have a mansion, so we use that. Jesus further tells them that what they ask in his name, he will do to glorify the Father. And then he reminds them that if they love him, they will keep his commandments. Now, that's the first time in John 14 that comes up. There's a correlation here. If you love me, you will obey my commandments. Jesus then promises that once I leave, the Holy Spirit's going to come. And then he tells them again, "By the way, it is he who obeys my commands that loves me." And then, for the third time in the same chapter, Jesus in chapter 14 says, "If anyone loves me, he will obey my teaching." Almost like Jesus trying to hammer this point home. Three times in one chapter, you said the exact same thing. After that, the 11 head out to the Mount of Olives. Now remember, there are 11 because Judas left, right? Judas was going to go do what Judas had to go do. Now on the way, Jesus tells them that tonight they're going to be scattered like the prophecies say they will be scattered. And Peter one more time says, "Even if everybody else leaves you, Lord, I'm not going to do it." And Peter tells Jesus a second time, "Even if I have to die for you, Jesus, I'm not going to leave you tonight." And then everybody else is like, well, Peter's not the only one that can do that. So they all made the promise. Lord, I won't make that. Don't do it. Now I realize, of course, that this is their Lord and Master whose predictions have never gone wrong. Who's just told them, y'all all going to leave. Nope, no landing. And again, they sort of miss the irony there of what they're doing. So Jesus tells them about him being the vine and them being the branches. Jesus is the vine. They are supposed to be the branches. They are supposed to be producing fruit. And the fascinating thing to me is that he tells them, do you know how you'll know that as a branch you are alive? He says, if you obey my commandments, you will remain in my love. Just as I have obeyed the Father, and I remain in his love. This man is a man who's on his way to die. And we're talking about love. And more love. Love for each other. Love for Christ. Love for God. You guys need to get this. I'm running short on time. You need to learn to love one another. Love comes with some tags. How do I know you love me? Because you obey the things I said to do. Jesus then commands them to love each other again before he spends a period of time and he talks to them about the persecution to come. And after doing this, Jesus begins to pray, and he prays first for himself. And after he prays for himself, he prays for the protection of the Father for his disciples because he knows what is coming. And he does this in their presence. Again, it is a powerful thing to have a brother or sister pray for you in your presence. All of the disciples are here and listening at this point as Jesus prays for the Father to protect them. This group of people that he's already told them, don't scatter tonight. But I'm asking my Father to look after you. And then he prays for those who will believe in me through your message. Who's he praying for? You? Me? Jesus spent time on the night of his betrayal. He's going to the cross. He's on that road. It's not reversible at this point. He's going to the cross. And what's he looking at? The future? You? Me? Wow. Remember we started this year talking about goals, and we talked about short-term goals, and we talked about long-term goals and what it takes to stay focused? I don't know that I have to stay focused. I'm going to die. I have less than 24 hours left, and I'm focused on the long-term goal. Father, be with those people who are going to hear the message that my 12 or 11 at this point are going to send out. That's focus. Jesus then asked Peter, James, and John to step away with him while he prays. And Jesus prays to the Father, and an angel comes to minister him to him. The Father hears his prayer. But again, as we talked about this morning in class, the answer is no. Jesus says, Lord, if it's your will, let this cup pass from me. But one of the things Jesus does to prove his obedience, he says, but Father, not my will, but yours be done. Now, Jesus comes back to Peter, James, and John, and they're speaking. And he's not overly stoked with them. He says, y'all, you need to be praying too, not sleeping. You'll have time to sleep, this ain't it. And he goes apart to pray again, and he does that twice more, and he comes back the third time, and he tells them, y'all might as well get up now, Judas is here. And so they do that. And Jesus asks Judas, have you come to betray me with a kiss? To which Judas replies, Rabbi! And he kisses him. Because, of course, that's the signal that he's already given to the guards. Do thy kiss. That's Jesus. That's the one you need to arrest. So Jesus turns to the soldiers, and he asks them, who is it you're looking for? And they say, well, Jesus of Nazareth. He says, I'm he. And the text says that the men retreated or fell down. There is a lot of conjecture as to why they retreated or fell down. You're talking about a bunch of dudes with spears, swords, and clubs. Jesus says, that's me, and they all back up. Kind of an interesting scene. So Jesus says it again. He says, who is it you're looking for? And they say, well, Jesus of Nazareth. He says, well, I told you that's me. If you're looking for me, feel free to let the rest of these guys go. What's he doing? Protecting his disciples. But bless his heart, this is when Peter decides to get involved again. And poor old Malchus. Malchus is clearly in the wrong place at the wrong time. By the way, this is a Trivial Pursuit answer. It's right here that gets cut off. Jesus tells Peter, put the sword away. By the way, why is he telling Peter to put the sword away? Somebody just saved their life. Hello, you were looking for me. The rest of these guys can go away. Peter, with a contingent of soldiers in front of him, whips out a sword. Hello? That was not a good career move on Peter's part. But one of the things that fascinates me is what happens next. Jesus asks Peter, he says, do you really think I can't call on God and he'll give me an army of angels? But this is the way it's going to go. And what fascinates me is nobody grabs Peter. Peter still gets to run away. With a contingent of armed guards standing there. Peter whacks off this guy here, and you've got to know he wasn't aiming for his ear. The ear was incidental or accidental, however you want to say that. But Jesus, who had already been seized by the guards, walks over to Malchus. And heals him on the spot. One of the things I guess that just struck me is, why is he walking around freely? Didn't they already seize him? Go read the text. It says they already seized him. And yet Jesus gets to walk over to Malchus and heal him. Now, if I just had my ear whacked off, I'm not sure how still I would be if somebody else came in my head. But Malchus is clever enough to stand there and let him heal him. And then Jesus turns to the chief priests, the officers, and the others, and he says, we need to talk. He said, y'all have messed up. I have been in the temple every single day. Why didn't you come get me then? But again, Jesus is loose. He's having a conversation. Who's controlling the situation? It's clearly Jesus. You've got a contingent of soldiers, a contingent of guards, all of whom are armed, and Jesus is wandering around having the conversations doing things he wants to do. Jesus is still in control. Remember when Jesus said, nobody takes my life, I laid it down? This would be proved. But Jesus talks to this group of chief priests, officers, and elders again, and he says, but this is your hour when darkness reigns. You have to know that didn't go over well. But you also knew that they understood what he's saying. He was right. So all of the disciples deserted him and fled to fulfill prophecy. Do you remember? Less than 6 hours ago, 11 guys, Lord, I'll die with you before I leave. And now they're all gone. There's just Jesus and this contingent of soldiers. Now, Jesus gets taken to Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year, and Peter is asked for the first time if he's one of Jesus' disciples, and he's like, nope, not me. So meanwhile, Annas asks Jesus about his teaching, and Jesus says, you know what? You don't really need to ask me what I've been teaching. I taught every day in the daylight. I haven't hidden anything. Why don't you go chat with one of those people I taught and ask them what I taught? Because I wasn't making a secret of it. Well, that's when an official whose name we don't know smacks him in the face and says, that's not how you talk to a high priest. Now remember that Annas is not currently the high priest. He's rotating with Caiaphas. But anyway, So Jesus asked the man who hit him in the face, he said, look, if I just said a lie, feel free to whack me again, but if I didn't lie, tell me why you hit me. You'll notice there's no further conversation. Now, at this point, Jesus gets sent to Caiaphas, who is actually the high priest at the time. Now, Peter comes along. He's following at a distance. Peter sits down near a fire to wait for Jesus. And while he's sitting there, a girl sees him and accuses him of being a follower of Jesus. But he assures her in no uncertain terms that he doesn't know who Jesus is. Now, Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, they were looking for some charge with which to put Jesus to death. And they've been looking for this at this point for a while. There are a lot of false witnesses against them, but they couldn't even get the false witnesses to keep their stories straight. They contradicted one another. And as an aside, all those false witnesses that came forward that couldn't keep their stories together, the Old Testament tells us they should all die on the spot. Because you're looking for a reason to kill Jesus. Well, if you lie in court about an accused, you are supposed to suffer the penalty they would have suffered if you had told the truth. If they were actually guilty. We don't read about any of these false witnesses dying. So Caiaphas finally asked Jesus, are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God? And Jesus replies, I am. That answer sets them off. And the trial's over. And as far as they were concerned, the council had heard blasphemy, and they condemned Jesus to death. Now, at this point, the guards begin to mock Jesus. They beat him. They place a blindfold on him. And they say, hey, why don't you prophesy? Who's backing you now? Meanwhile, back at the fire, someone else came up to Peter and told him, surely you're with Jesus because your accent sounds just like his. And Peter says, I don't know the man. And just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked at Peter. Can you imagine standing in Peter's shoes at that point? I find that one hard. I have to think, Brother Kahn said this morning in the class, he's like, well, later in his life, Peter didn't mention this one. And he didn't. This has got to be a low point in Peter's life. Peter, who's promised twice, Lord, I'll die with you. I wouldn't desert you. I wouldn't deny you. And now he's done both. He hears the rooster and he goes, oh no. And he's close enough to Christ that Christ looks at him. How hard was that? But do you remember what Jesus gave him? Peter doesn't yet, but he will. Jesus gave Peter grace before he needed it. The text tells us that Peter runs out, and he weeps bitterly. Now, by daybreak, the council of elders have condemned Jesus to death, and then we see a very different reaction. This one is from Judas, and he apparently didn't intend for Jesus to be condemned to death, and he is sorry. He tries to return the betrayal money, but the priest won't take it back because it's blood money, and the law forbids them to take blood money. Now, apparently it was okay to take money out of the treasury to pay for blood money, but it's not okay to put money back into the treasury that's been used as blood money. So Judas chucks the money into the temple because he wants nothing to do with it at this point. And he goes and hangs himself. And the priests, being the good guys that they are, well, we can't put it in the treasury, might as well do something with it. They go out and buy a field where they can bury foreigners. The Jews bound up Christ and took him to Pilate. Pilate told them to judge him themselves. You got a court, do it. And they said, well, we did that, but we want him executed, and we don't have the authority to do that. So Pilate questions Jesus, and he can't find a reason to execute him. And Pilate went back out to the people and was like, y'all, the dude doesn't deserve to die. But the people complained that he'd been causing trouble from Galilee down to Jerusalem, and Pilate, boom, got this one. You know who's in town? It's Herod. He's a Galilean. He's Herod's problem. So he ships him off to Herod. Now Herod is stoked because Herod's always wanted to see Jesus, largely because he's hoping that Jesus will perform circus tricks for him. Jesus doesn't even speak to Herod. And so Herod and his soldiers mock him and ridicule him and send him back to Pilate. Pilate tells the people that neither Herod nor himself could find any reason to kill Jesus. But Pilate says, "Hey, you know that I usually release a prisoner to you on the Passover. Why don't I just release Jesus?" But the people instead choose to have Pilate release Barabbas, a known convicted murderer and insurrectionist. So Pilate offers to scourge Jesus to try and placate the people. Pilate does not want this man dead. There's no guilt that he can find. He cannot find a reason to crucify him, so he has him flogged. The soldiers weave that crown of thorns. They put it on his head. They take a staff and they beat him with it. And Jesus is in terrible shape. He looks awful at this point. There's lots of blood involved, which is why that's a blank slide. And he takes Jesus out to the crowd again and he says, "Behold, the man." Now what he's trying to do is elicit some sympathy so he can turn him loose. But the people are still adamant that Jesus be crucified. So Pilate takes Jesus back inside the palace when he learns that the Jews are accusing him of blasphemy, calling himself the Son of God. And Jesus seems to have pity on Pilate when he tells Pilate, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you by God. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." Pilate's struggling. He sees what's about to happen here. He's about to have a full-blown riot on his hands. He again doesn't want that at all. Pilate then symbolically washes his hands and says, "I'm not turning him over to you, but this is on you." And the people agree that they will take Jesus' blood guilt on themselves and on their children. Christ is given his cross to carry, and he finds out that he is so weak at this point that he can't carry it. And so Simon of Cyrene is pressed into service to carry the cross for Christ, and as he's going down the road, women begin to weep for him. This is a man who's on his way to die. He's not in good shape, but he turns around to these women. And he says, "Don't weep for me. Weep for Jerusalem. Because things are about to get a lot worse." Now, I just have to tell you, at that point in my life, I'm not sure how worried about other folk I would be. And Jesus is still focused on showing sympathy, showing love to these people who he's come to save. There are two other men headed toward Golgotha. They were criminals. And Jesus then asked God to forgive the people who are crucifying him because they don't know what they're doing. Can you imagine the wrath of God? Christ is offering grace to people who are nailing them to a cross. So Pilate writes an inscription on the cross in three languages. Why? Again, we sort of touched on that in class this morning. What languages are these people speaking? Aramaic, Latin, Greek. He's got it up there in all three languages. The King of the Jews. Now, the Pharisees, the scribes, the chief priests, they're not happy with this. They go back to Pilate and they say, no, you've got to change that with some qualifiers. How about if you write, "He says he's the King of the Jews"? Pilate's over these people. I mean, just so over these people. And he tells them, "I wrote what I wrote." And that audience is done. So it stays. The soldiers at the foot of the cross divide Christ's clothes, but they don't want to rip his undergarments because it's seamless. And so they decide to roll dice or cast lots for it, which fulfills yet another prophecy. And the crowd spends some time mocking him, and the soldiers offer him wine vinegar. And one of the criminals starts hurling insults at Jesus, just like the crowd is. But the other criminal turns to Christ and asks for mercy. And even there on the cross, Jesus offers that mercy. Jesus continues to offer love as he looks down from the cross and sees his mom. Yes, John, to take her in. Jesus is the oldest son. It's his job to take care of her. And with some of his last breath, he's trying to take care of her. For 3 hours, I think it's dark. Josephus tells us that there's not an eclipse. They can't explain the darkness. A lot of people say, oh, who cares about eclipses? You know that we can measure those? We can figure out when those are? Who can see those? It's a mathematical thing. I don't get into them. I'm guessing Jim could do that for you, but I can't. But Josephus says, this is not an eclipse. It got dark, and nobody could figure out why for 3 hours. And then Jesus cries out, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then he cries out and says, it is finished. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And he dies. At that very moment, when Christ dies, the temple curtain is ripped from the top to the bottom. What does that curtain represent? Represents the separation of the people from God, yes? That's taken back. Veil, gone. Torn in two. The miracle here comes fast and furious. We get an earthquake, the rocks split, tombs break open, bodies of holy people are raised to life. They come out of the tombs, and after 3 days, they go into the holy city and appear to people. Now here's my question, what are they doing for 3 days? I mean, we don't know, I'm just curious. You got a bunch of people who have been dead for who knows how long, and the text tells us that they don't go back into the city until after Jesus' resurrection. What do they do for 3 days? Have a conference? I don't know, it's just struck me as interesting. Now the centurion that's at the foot of the cross, he sees the darkness. He feels the earthquake. He's watching the rocks and he's like, uh-oh. Maybe that really was the Son of God. Now, the next day was supposed to be a special Sabbath. Now what that means is that they were supposed to celebrate a Sabbath on a day that was not a Saturday. So the Jews didn't want the bodies hanging there. So they asked for Pilate to break the legs of the people on the cross so they'll die faster so they can take the bodies down. So the soldiers broke the legs of the two criminals, but when they come to Jesus, they find out he's already dead. And so they stab him in his side with a spear, and blood and water flow down. And they realize they don't need to break his legs because he's already dead. And this too fulfilled the prophecy, because the prophecy said that not one of his bones would be broken. Now as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea went to Pilate and asked for the body of Christ. And that was a bold thing to do. First of all, he has access to Pilate. Second, he's asking for a man who just a minute ago the crowds were looking to crucify. Now Pilate says, you mean he's dead already? He's surprised. And the centurion confirms, yep, I stabbed him in the side, he's dead. So Pilate gives him permission, and Joseph and Nicodemus take Jesus' body, they prepare it with myrrh and aloe, wrap the body with linens, and Joseph takes Jesus to a tomb that he had prepared for himself, and rolled a big stone in front of it, and went away, so that he wasn't unclean. Now, the next day, the one after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate and asked him to seal the tomb. They were afraid the disciples would come back and steal the body and claim that Jesus was alive, and in their opinion, that would create a worse mess than they had to start with. Now, again, remember, Pilate's over this. He was pressured into a decision that he didn't want to make by people that he doesn't really like, and now they're back. He's dead. So Pilate says to them, "You feel free to make the tomb as secure as you can make it. You need to guard the dead dude. Go ahead. You have guards. Go do that." And so they do. They go and secure the tomb. They guard the tomb. Now, Jesus is dead. He's in the tomb. It's under guard. It's under seal. Now what do they got to do?
Have to wait.
How long?
3 days.
Because he said he would rise again on the third day. So all they've got to do is wait till the fourth day and they're good. Right? If they can keep him in there for 4 days, they're good. And then they can let the guards go home. The story doesn't end there, of course. But it's going to end today. For the rest of the story, you need to come back next week. Now, Jesus loved us an awful lot to go through all that, to pray for us, for our well-being, for our salvation. And there he is, in the tomb. Next week, the story changes. Just out of curiosity, how many of you saw the film The Titanic? Leonardo DiCaprio. Okay. How many of you knew the ending to the story before you went? You know what? I read somewhere about people, young people who didn't know how the film ended, and older people were standing in line talking about how the film ended, and they were mad. For those of you who can't come back next week, he doesn't stay there. The guards aren't as effective as perhaps the Pharisees were hoping they were. So come back next week so you can learn the rest of the story.